Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lab. Well, folks, full disclosure, Rex and I were not supposed to have another episode the week of November 3rd, but news happens. We want to bring it to you. And apparently, Rex, you've got some takes to uncork because the big news that has come out this week, which has been rumored for months, is that LIV Golf, which again, Roman numeral 54, is changing one of its central tenets from 54 holes of competition to 72 holes of competition. There's a lot of layers to this. There's a lot of nuance to this. But Rex, what was your reaction when you got the news release or the news that this was going to be the way it's going to be starting in 2026?
I don't even know what you would call Roman numeral LXXII. Is that right? Did I do that right?
You would call it messy.
Yeah, yes. It's very messy. I don't like having the wall back between us. I've got to be honest with you. After our podcast on Monday, got a lot of good feedback on that one. Apparently our mics sounded good. I think people like it when we're sitting next to each other. So we'll certainly do that more next year. I do find this fascinating. Two fronts, and you and I were just on Golf Today sort of discussing this. The idea of expanding to 72 holes as a way to try to ingratiate LIV Golf itself into getting world ranking points. I kind of agree with what Rory McIlroy said today. He's playing on the DP World Tour in their finals events. It doesn't make any sense because not being 54 holes was a problem when it came to the official world golf ranking decided not to give them points originally. It wasn't the problem. It was mathematically they could work their way around it. That wasn't the bigger issue. But I think this applies to what we've heard from players over the last really year or two. And I will give credit, full credit, to John Rahm. He seemed to be pounding the drum louder than anyone else. And it's been pretty clear. I think both you and I have talked about this on numerous occasions. The idea that maybe 54 holes of teen golf and shorts and loud music aren't the best way for at least John Rahm to prepare for the major championships. And if you're John Rahm or you're Hatton or you're Bryson DeChambeau, you're going to lean towards, I still want to win majors. Like that's still the most important thing in my career. So I think that has more to do with this than anything else. I did find it interesting that Tyrrell Hatton today on the DP World Tour said that after the first season, LIV players were given a questionnaire and asked, do you want to expand from 54 to 72 holes? And I think his comment was three said yes.
Yeah. Three players said they wanted to go from 54
which
holes
to 72
holes. Which makes
sense. Because if you asked me, do I want to work, if I took a job working 3 days a week and you asked me, do you want to work 5 days a week?
Tread carefully. You're saying would you do more work for the same amount of money?
Yes, your answer that's exactly would be what's happening there. So everyone was kind of like, I can see Dustin Johnson and a couple of the other ones being like, nah, man.
Nah, fam.
Like
I'm
54.
Good.
But this seems to be a paradigm shift. And again, this goes to what John Rahm has vocalized on numerous occasions. The idea that you can't come up with any sort of momentum after 54 holes as opposed to 72 holes. When you're used to that being the benchmark, that's how you decide a champion is 72 holes. I get that. I understand it. It makes it messy because you've invested your entire future, your entire marketing effort into LIV, L-I-V, being 54 in Roman numerals. And so I guess you're going to have to work around that somehow. I understand that. But if they did this as some sort of ploy to help out on the world ranking front, it seems hollow.
It certainly seems hollow. And that's why there's so much to unpack here. And you're right. John Rahm has been insistent, basically ever since he moved over to LIV in winter 2023, that he would like to see the league shift from 54 holes to 72 holes. It's a tried and true method. And I sort of chuckled seeing the press release that came out from the LIV Golf folks and some of the quotes from Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau, among others, saying, you know, this, you know, obviously they're putting a positive spin on this, that the interest has been so phenomenal on site that they want to provide another day of competition to sort of appease folks that way. Obviously, another day of competition would be more expensive from a television production standpoint, but potentially they could get a higher media rights fee to be garnered for that if there's another day of competition that way, moving from 54 to 72 holes. And look, I do think the move from a pure logical standpoint of moving to 72 holes was the right move, because I do think that it brings a level of legitimacy to the competition. One thing that you and I have struggled and countless others have struggled with since the league launched in 2022 was, what do the results mean? What does it mean that you played 54 holes against this competition on golf courses where we don't have a whole lot of data? Now, I do think it is easier to extrapolate what happens inside the ropes for sort of the wider picture. You know, we can contextualize their results and their performances easier. I understand that. And I do think you're going to see probably a normalization of some of the results, where there is certainly a different cadence to 54 holes and 72 holes. That's just obvious. There's, you have to start faster, you have to end quicker. 72 holes is not necessarily a slog, it's more of a slow burn. But there's a reason why major championships are 72 holes. They are the perfect number. It's not too short, you can potentially shoot yourself out of it. It's not too long, where it just sort of drags on and it can be sort of lifeless and not very compelling. There is a reason why they've been doing this for decades, if not centuries. And so where I think LIV is sort of caught now in a crossroads is that it wanted to be revolutionary. It wanted to be fresh. It wanted to be innovative. It wanted to instill and imbue the sense of invigoration that golf and LIV golf were going to be different. And instead, they've just gone back to what is tried and true, the same old thing. They are now one among the establishment and in sort of more in line with the mainstream tours. And so I think now is a point for LIV. How can we differentiate ourselves from what the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and literally dozens of other tours around the world are actually doing?
You could lean into the team element a little bit more, although that carries its own issues, because that is probably a much, much bigger sticking point when it comes to getting world ranking points. So you're sort of boxing yourself into the corner, depending on what you want to do. I think this came up during our roundtable, and you and I have discussed it before. Lean into the offseason moves. Like, everybody loves the transaction. Like, when it comes to the NBA, and this is, let's go to the NFL. Like, both you and I are fixated on what trades are happening and what trades aren't happening. It has become sort of part of sportdom, where you want to know who's getting traded where, what are the rumors, what are the teams going to look like, what are the finances behind this. Like, that to me is fascinating, and they've never done that before either. But you're right. The idea that we were 54 holes, we were golf but different, we were golf but louder, whatever it is you want to call it, now you've sort of put yourself into a situation where, nope, you're almost the exact same golf that we see week in and week out on the PGA Tour, and to your point, all over the world. So it's a move from a marketing perspective, from an individuality perspective, in the wrong direction. But again, I understand why they did it. I don't know how it's going to play out, though.
So the official World Golf Ranking point, and it's obvious this was another sort of check mark in what has been a pursuit ever since they announced a couple of months ago that they were going to reapply for official World Golf Ranking points. They've all these players who have jumped since 2022 have been starved from those points. They've obviously tumbled down the official World Golf rankings if they have not won a major championship. I do think that it's a matter of when, not if, these LIV players are going to receive world ranking points. Because again, this was just one sort of avenue. They had to. I don't even think 54 holes was the chief obstacle, but they've certainly made it easier for LIV now to fall in line with other tours. It was also the pathways. It was also the gateways. It was also the team component. It was also the closed shop nature. And they've done at least incremental moves. It seems like they have a checklist and they're just going one by one. Is this would satisfy the folks at the official World Golf Ranking? So I do understand that from that perspective. But when you look at the world ranking, Rex, there's only four players currently on LIV who are inside the top 100. And so, to Roy McIlroy's point, is that once these players actually get world ranking points, the Dustin Johnsons and the Brooks Koepkas and the Cam Smiths of the world, their world ranking has been so diluted from largely not receiving enough points over the past couple of years that the strength of field is going to be so poor, so weak anyway, that these players, barring something extraordinary, are going to have a really hard time cracking the top 100. Cracking the top 60, cracking the top 50 in the world ranking to actually gain major access, which is what Greg Norman promised back in 2022, which has not transpired, and which is obviously the main driver for why LIV would want to get world ranking points to begin with, is the major championship access.
And it's diminishing returns. And Rory is absolutely right on this front. However, I will say, when the LIV Golf announced that it had reapplied world ranking points, and that was in July, I was at the Scottish Open, I remember walking up to Trevor Immelman, who was working on the telecast, he's also the governor of the official World Golf Ranking Board, and just kind of tried to get an idea of why would they do this again? Why would Live Golf apply again when nothing seems to have changed since the last time this was put up for a vote outside of a handful of the board members on the official World Golf ranking? And I'm not quite sure that's going to make a difference one way or the other. And the indication was, didn't come out and say it, but there was an idea that there was going to be some conversation, that there was going to be a little bit more back and forth than there was originally about, okay, if you do this, we'll take this application a little bit more seriously. You look at what they've done with the promotion and the relegation. That seemed to be one of the major sticking points. They have now expanded essentially to four players playing their way off and playing their way on versus the promotions event, which will be held in Florida. That's a whole nother issue going forward as well. And the Asians event. So that is more than they had initially when they had applied for the world ranking points. And the board made it clear then that they weren't comfortable. That wasn't enough. Let's call it churn, because that seems to be the PGA Tour word. There wasn't enough players falling in and out. I'm not quite sure four is going to be enough either, but at least it's a step in the right direction. It still remains to be seen how you even work these four players into other teams, or maybe you create their own team. So that created a conversation as well. But the team golf element was also an issue. If you and I are coming down the stretch and you're my teammate, and I realize it's probably better for you if you win the 18th hole, then that sort of circumvents whatever individual competition you think is going on at that time. So there's still some very real sticking points beyond the idea that, yes, you expanded promotion. Yes, you expanded to 72 holes. There's still issues.
Yeah, that's sort of the point that I wanted to get into now, because we didn't get your viewpoint of this during the Golf Today roundtable. My at least theory or hypothesis that maybe the team element is the next to go, because Liv has spent basically the past 4 years trumpeting these franchises, talking about how profitable they can and will be. But I think by any objective measure, it has not resonated with a large scale audience, the team concept. And now when you're even broadening and lengthening the amount of stroke play competition, where literally the Crushers team total, you are just adding up over 72 holes and they're declared the winner. That is so secondary to now, by going to 72 holes, which is very clearly an individual competition. That is the recognized number of holes, and that is the sort of the recognized tournament structure. Is 72 holes of competition. It is going to be an individual-based performance. That is what the league is going to be. And so, if you have already removed one of the central tenets of Live Golf, which is supposed to be the disruptor in 54 holes and doing something differently, why not then, Rex, just abandon the team concept altogether? Why not even have these team races? Why not just essentially create a bloated world global circuit of major championship winners, former world number ones? Maybe you increase the field sizes to 70 players. You're touching parts of the global economy that maybe weren't accessed previously. Why not just lean into LIV Golf being the global tour, thus putting it and a pretty intense rivalry with the DP World Tour?
As a colleague of ours once said, what am I doing here? What are we even doing? If that's what we're going to do, what are we doing here? This makes no sense whatsoever. I think you might be conflating a little bit, though, on this front, because I would argue, yes, going to 72 holes, and I think it was a huge paradigm shift is what I called it. I think if you did away with the team concept altogether, that's a seismic shift. Then you just become another tour, another global tour. Now you're going head-to-head with the DP World Tour, which already has established tournaments, you have established corporate partners, you have established media partners. Like, what's the use behind that? The whole tenet behind essentially what was the Premier Golf League, PGL, way back in the day, this predated Live Golf. Let's go back to the foundations, the origin story. This was whispered about underneath the tree at Augusta National almost a decade ago now. Everyone sort of saw this coming, that they were coming up with this sort of global circuit that would incorporate the best parts of team golf. Because let's don't stick our head in the sand here. This was based on the success of the Ryder Cup. And everyone saw how profitable that was from a business model, what that meant, and what it meant to the fans to be able to suddenly, you're not just cheering for Scottie Scheffler. You're cheering for, and again, this is a bad comparison because no one really cheers for the Range Goats, but that's what they were trying to get at. So if you do away with that, now you've just become another global circuit that's going to compete against the DP World Tour for second place, and you'll be nowhere close to the PGA Tour. I'll go back to the world ranking.
But they could dominate, Rex, the ex-US market, right? Like everything outside the US could be Live/PIF's domain.
Perhaps. And again, you're looking long-term on that front, but that's not what the Public Investment Fund signed up for. Essentially, what Yasir Al-Rumayyan wants is to redefine the game. He is married to the idea of team golf. And I will back up to the world golf ranking question, because when that announcement happened that they were trying to get points again in July, I remember talking to a handful of players about the idea that even with diminishing returns, even with just four players inside the top 50 and your strength of field is not going to be very good starting out. But every player I talked to said, and these are players who hadn't gone to LIV Golf, said that if the world ranking part of the equation wasn't an issue, when the conversation came up, do you join LIV Golf, do you take the money, or do you stay with the establishment? Do you stay with the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour? That would have changed the dynamic. That would have changed the narrative dramatically for a lot of different players. Told me point blank that yes, if we were to have believed what Greg Norman, the CEO at the time, was telling the world and telling everyone who was signing up, that yes, we'll get world ranking points. Only the foolish who believed it are the ones who now are snake bitten, because everyone else knew that that wasn't going to be the case. But if somehow that becomes the case, even if you're looking long term, even if you're thinking to yourself, this is going to be a 5-year process to build those points back up to the point that it actually makes a difference, then yes, I think it could be meaningful.
I just think, and maybe this is forecasting too much, but I don't think it's unrealistic to wonder what the future of the team golf component could be, because I always thought that there might be an appetite for team competition in sort of a limited window, maybe sure. 3 events, maybe 4 events, maybe 5 events. I think we have proof now, Rex, in year 4, that there is not an appetite for team golf spread over 14 weeks and about
not
6 months
this form
of a calendar season. They have hemorrhaged $5 billion reportedly in sinking into this endeavor with very little to show for it. The TV audience is still minimal. The commercial sponsorship is still minimal. They haven't gotten sort of a second or third wave of players to join the league without sort of any other perks other than the 9-figure signing bonuses, which have certainly dried up. And so I just wonder if that is sort of the future. The PGA Tour strategic alliance with the DP World Tour expires in a couple of years, so it could potentially be ripe for this sort of takeover as well. You just wonder if they'd already abandoned 54 holes, what's next as it relates to LIV Golf? And it's pretty clear the top players have a say as well.
And look, the other part of this element that we're probably not going to get to is the announcement that the LPGA Tour was going to co-sanction an event with the Ladies European Tour, the LET, that was going to be essentially co-sanctioned by Golf Saudi, which is funded entirely by the Public Investment Fund. And I think I've joked on this podcast before that had LIV Golf been called the Aramco series, apparently that wasn't an issue. Now, that's not an entirely fair joke, because they were two different animals and they were vastly different products, and it wasn't nearly as contentious on the ladies' side as it was on the men's side. Being optimistic, which our friend Jordan Cornette was not, he was channeling his inner Eamon Lynch during today's golf today. However, being optimistic, it could create a pathway. To your point, what if the PGA Tour just ceded the fall to whatever they want to turn team golf into? You and I have argued in the past that maybe they shouldn't be playing golf in the fall. This is an opportunity for the tour to go dark and people to look forward to January and the tour starting up its normal season. That's very much in play. And then you bring the DP World Tour into it, because that would be a bunch more global tour if you were to take it on the road. We've seen the limited success LIV Golf has had in Adelaide, in Australia. So yes, I can see that as a pathway moving forward. That's being wildly optimistic, however, considering that the two sides, the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund, haven't spoken in almost a year now.
There is one other thing that I wanted to get to, Rex, and we mentioned it briefly, was the promotions event, which LIV announced a couple of days ago as well. It's going to be at Black Diamond Ranch, about, 2 hours from you, in the Canto, Florida. It's going to be in early January. They did increase, LIV did, the number of available spots for players to earn access to
doubled.
2026 LIV season. Yes, they went from 1 to 2. That is, of course, in addition to the top 2 finishers on the international series, on the Asian tour, not already exempt. That was sort of the loophole that was not utilized last year, because Joaquin Niemann was one of those finishers on the Asian tour's order of merit. And so those players also are going to be on the LIV League. It's sort of unclear at this point how they're going to be incorporated into the teams. Maybe they form another team. I believe that'd be the 14th live team. Maybe they just play as wild cards and play as individuals. That is still unclear. But what did you make of that move? Because previously, this promotions event had been overseas. Now they're putting it in Florida in January, seemingly trying to make it easier for players in the U.S. and Americans to try and sign up for this and test their luck to see if they can finish among the top two.
Yeah, I think the move was to make it easier for the top players who play almost primarily in the United States, easier for them to travel to as opposed to the way it had been in the past. You cannot tell me, though, they didn't know that the pushback was going to come from the PGA Tour, who has a very clear North America clause. So if you go back to previous years when this promotions event has been played overseas, you can get a conflicting event release. Even if you're not a member, you can still get a conflicting event release from the PGA Tour, and there are no repercussions from playing in just the promotions event. That this is, does not apply to LIV Golf events, clearly. However, by moving it to the United States, now pretty much you've done away with any player with any kind of status whatsoever with the PGA Tour or any player at all. That's the part I'm going to get hung up on, because the PGA Tour's policy has been really clear, and this predates LIV Golf by a long time. This did not come up just because the Saudis wanted to get in golf. The North America clause has been a part of the PGA Tour regulations for a very long time, and they're just applying them. I have no problem when it comes to members, because the members have signed that document and said, okay, these are the rules and regulations I'm willing to abide by. Where I'm going to get caught up, and you saw me on the phone right before we started taping this pod, I was on the phone with one of many agents who reached out to me since that story broke yesterday about, if you're going to start running into legal problems, the PGA Tour running into legal problems, that's where you're going to do it. When you're threatening non-members, people who don't have any association at all with the PGA Tour, with a one-year suspension of playing in any PGA Tour event, that includes a Monday qualifying event, that's where I think, I'm not a lawyer, I don't want to play one on this podcast, but certainly I feel like the consensus right now is the tour can't legally do that.
It does seem particularly harsh, particularly for a player who does not have a status.
Andy Ogletree being the primary example. If you need a comp on that one, and he did have some very limited status on the Korn Ferry Tour, but he wasn't qualified for any of the events he missed. And so that one to me was always questionable. But now you're talking about you, who played so well just a few days ago when we were up at the Hammock Beach Resort. If you wanted to try your hand at the promotions event and somehow got into the field, you would be barred from participating in any PGA Tour related events. That includes a Monday qualifier. That doesn't seem fair at face value.
That's too bad, because I have had a lot of suitors reach out to me, extend tournament invites for 2026, looking at my
if only can, you could get over your elbow issue, it'd be much better, right?
Yes, I will say yes, that is very sore right now. I did go slow motion, picture by picture, frame by frame of my swing, trying to figure out exactly what went wrong. There are a number of issues with my golf swing. Chief among them is my posture. I think I'm in a very bad position at the start of my golf swing, which then leads me into a bad position at the top of my backswing, which of course leads me into a bad position at impact. I'm going to be addressing that over the next couple of days. I'll have to keep folks updated on my progress, because I do feel like I'm on the verge of a breakthrough.
And I thought about this after we did the podcast when I was driving home on Monday. You are the most inconsistent good player I've ever played golf with. And by that, I mean it as a very backhanded compliment. But if you came to the golf course tomorrow and you told me, I shot 78 yesterday, I'd have been like, yeah, I could see that happening. You drive the ball a mile. You drive it plenty far enough. And what I saw in your putting the other day with whatever it is, that grip you're working on, seemed to be working well. When you're playing well without any wind, you can shoot 78 easy. But if you also showed up and thought, shot 98, I'd been like, yeah, I can see that as well. If I told you I shot 78, you'd be like, that didn't happen.
That did not happen.
If I told you I shot 98, you'd be like, of course, that's exactly what happened.
No, I used to be good. I used to be good at golf. I was the number one player on my high school team. The three or four preceding rounds to this slugfest a pillow fight that you and I had on Monday at Hammock Beach, I'd shot in the 70s. Like, yeah, I could play good golf, but yes, I'm very, very inconsistent. And why am I inconsistent? I believe my hypothesis is that I'm inconsistent because I have inconsistent fundamentals. And if I can improve my posture at address, who knows? This could be a big breakthrough. You and I are going to have a pod early next week as scheduled, which was on the schedule, of course. You and I will be doing that. I will have an update on if I've stumbled across a breakthrough. If not, any swing coaches who are listening, please hit me up. Find me on Twitter. Find me on Instagram. Find my email, get my phone number, reach out, a brother needs some help. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys know the drill. NBCSports.com/golf, aka golfchannel.com. Folks, I cannot stress enough, golfchannel.com is
easy
back
for you to say.
Please hit us up on there as well. We have plenty of good content on the site, analysis, videos, and the like. In the meantime, have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. Rex and I will be back early next week for another edition of the pod. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Talk to you guys next week.
15 minutes always turns into 25.